pleased to introduce Christine Hatton and Richard Sellers, who I'm going to introduce to more people this afternoon. Thank you so much.
Good. Well, thanks very much, everyone, for coming. Also, in absentia is the other editor of this particular book, Ed Duffy, who's unable to be with us here for Ideary. The book that we are talking about today is a new book which will come out in November, Drama Research Methods, Provocations of Practice. What we have around us here are some of the writers of the various chapters. And they, not only have they not heard what each other, or read what each other has written, in some instances they were unaware until we came to Ideary that some of the other writers were and that was partly scheming on our part. Yeah, we planned it, yeah. What I am going to do very quickly is just to read out the names of people who are not only not here today, but whose chapters or writings are not represented today, but are in the book. So that's Brad Haysman, Joe Salvatore, Nisha Shanjani, George Beliveau, Christine Sinclair, Liesl Terrett, Emma Selwyn, Alison Anders, Yasmin Candel, Joe Norris, and Lynn Fells. We will hear from them in due course when the book comes out. Chris, do you want to just talk a little bit about what the brief that we gave to our writers?
Yes, we wanted to create a text that was a little different from other types of research books, where we wanted people to have deep conversations with each other, both about theory, but also about practice as well, their research practice. And we wanted to ask them to go to the heart of what provoked them about their practice. So we didn't want it to be a happy conversation where they were simply, well, I've done this project, well, I've done this project, you know, it was like that. We actually wanted them to engage with each other and to work with a particular provocation. So some of the people we were a natural fit because of particular research interests or partnerships that had happened before, or for some, it was a partnership that was created just for the purpose of the text. And we gave everybody a particular question that we wanted them to work with, or a theme that we wanted them to address in their deep discussions. We also gave people the opportunity to choose the form that it would be delivered in that best suited their preparation, their ideas, and what the best fit was for their conversation.
Yeah, that was very interesting in itself. So we had a number of early queries from people along the lines of, so are you asking for what one might consider a traditional academic book chapter, or aren't you? How do we reference in this chapter then? Do you want a list of cited works or a bibliography at the end, or is it not that kind of... how does this kind of sit academically in the field? And we didn't dodge those bullets, but what we did was we threw it back to people and we said, well, you know, you need to make those decisions amongst yourselves, and we really do want to encourage you to experiment with the form. So we really want you to decide how you want this chapter to look. And as we will see today from our various speakers, those forms have taken many, there are many different forms within the book. And that was also one of the reasons that we went with the publisher that we did too, because this publisher was up for, if you like, a book that would have, that where no two chapters would look the same in terms of formatting, and where the writers actually got the choice of what form they would write their chapter in. The pairing up, as Chris said, I think in virtually every case, the writers had not written together before. And I think in just about every instance, it wasn't a case that the writers could even literally get together in the same room necessarily. And so there was a tyranny of distance between the writers. even if they were within the one country. And so how the writers navigated that writing with that challenge is actually part of not only what the challenge that we set the writers, but actually things that to varying degrees the writers have actually addressed within their chapters, which was quite interesting. We're going to ask the writers today to talk a little bit about their chapter, but also to treat you to an excerpt from their chapter. So we'll actually hear from their chapters, because many of the chapters do indeed speak for themselves. Is there anything else you want to say at the outset?
No, just that it's been such a fascinating, we'll talk about this later, but really fascinating exercise for us. But just to allow each other to be present in their conversation, a written conversation, or read or some grade, but and to be comfortable enough to share their practice, but also bounce practice back while exploring really quite deep ideas. And for some, that's been a really, I mean, we had a workshop based upon our one this morning, and so it's kind of led us to start thinking, gosh, we talk out, but we don't talk in. And that maybe that's a lovely new direction that we need to sort of be starting to think about in the way that we configure our research publications.
So let's get into the book. So after a foreword by Anne Harris, the first chapter is Touchstones of Practice, Consideration from the Theatre Workshop Floor by George Beliveau and Christine Sinclair, talking about their work as ethnodramatists. But now we're going to hear from Kelly, who worked on a chapter with Jo Raphael. And Jo's actually here at the conference at the Institute, but in fact is delivering a paper in another room as we speak. Kelly, you may wish to unpack this, because it's actually in capital letters with dashes and things, but it's active participation, social inclusion and drama research.
Yes, so to just visualise that a little bit, it's active participation, but with ACT, art, in capitals in those two words. And there's a reason for that, which I'm going to go into for a minute, but first to say thank you to Chris and Richard and to Peter in his absence for the opportunity to see him. It was a very interesting one, and I obviously know Jo's work very well, both Australian colleagues, and have a massive admiration for her work and affection for her as a person, but we had never worked together before. And so in terms of our process, we just started having these, because she's in Melbourne and I'm in Sydney, so thankfully both live in Australia, because we just started having these very long phone conversations. In the middle of the day, I think I may have even been on maternity leave or something, so it was in the middle of the day, I'd ring her when the baby went to bed, and we'd talk for as long as basically that child allowed me to at the time, so sometimes for hours. And the topic that we were given was drama research and social inclusion. And so the first thing that we grappled with as colleagues was to talk about, well, what do we understand social inclusion to be? Because there is a sort of a definition of social inclusion, or a sort of perception of social inclusion, that is about working with people with additional needs, people with disabilities. But we wanted to conceptualise it more broadly as we were talking about our practice and what we might talk about. And so we actually, in the end, talked about, and my computer has just, oh, there it is. So in the end we decided, there's a Centre for Analysis of Social Inclusion that talks about, well, what is social exclusion, to try and understand the concept. And they talk about if an individual in society is socially excluded, if they don't participate in key activities of the society that they live in. And so we considered that definition because it allowed us to have a really participatory focus in how we understood social inclusion, the opportunity and the ability to participate in activities important to a community. That's what we decided to kind of centre it around. Then we decided, because we thought that's central to a person being included in the community, and it's an active focus, and therefore it was the active art. So that's where the title came from, the definition and the way that we conceptualised it. What we did then was we started talking about instances of our research and our practices as artists, as theatre makers, as drama teachers, that has had some sort of a focus or an intention around that definition, or a troubled relationship with that definition. And so the way that we ended up presenting the chapter actually was born very much out of those conversations, because what we decided in the end to do, to facilitate our process, not with the idea that we were writing the chapter necessarily, but we went, okay, that's a really interesting sort of vignette that you just talked to me about, could you write that down and email it to me and I'll think about it and I'll email you some discussion points back and then we'll think about how to write the chapter. And we did this with a few vignettes and we actually decided in the end that that might be the way that we do present the chapter. So what we've ended up doing in the chapter is there's three vignettes, examples of us that we've sent out of things that happened in classrooms or particular projects that we did. And then a brief discussion of the person whose story that is, in terms of the person who was in the room and who sent the story. And then a discussion that went back and forth that's actually labelled, you know, KF, Kelly speaking now, Joe rank, Joe responded, trying to pick up on key things in a discursive format. So that's how the book is, our chapter is presented in the book. And that actually allows us some really interesting things, because like a conversation does, it allows us to go into on a thread. So I'm going to pick up on that one little thread you said there, and because that resonates with something that I've been thinking about for a while. And it is about thoughts and issues to do with our practice. And I know that I don't have much time, so I'll just go into reading this one section, and it is really just a couple of paragraphs, about one such instance of this, where I briefly mentioned well earlier up about getting ethics clearance for a project. And that's one of the things that Jo picked up, because it was obviously an issue that ran through her case study and her work too. And so this is her voice here, where she says, "You mentioned ethical clearance, and this is an important consideration in social inclusion research. In order to conduct research, we must first of all negotiate the process of research ethics." And there is nobody in the room that does not kind of, you know, breathe a bit of a sigh there. Because necessarily, measures are put in place to protect those who are considered most vulnerable. So in the example described in this chapter, the actors with disability were considered to be a socially recognised group, with special vulnerabilities and additional hurdles were added to the ethics application process. These applications are rarely expedited and almost always questioned. Persistence is required. When they cannot know the individuals, academics reviewing the ethics applications will often take an essentialist view of disability and make assumptions about limitations of self-determination of people with disabilities. So while protection of research participants is paramount, if a rigid and conservative view is taken by ethics committee, this can be a barrier to inclusion. Researchers can be deterred from conducting research involving people with a disability and other vulnerable groups because it's just too difficult to get the ethics clearance. When this happens, the most vulnerable groups in society can end up being excluded and disempowered by the very structures that are set up to support them. Socially inclusive research requires awareness of the differential access to power and privilege. The disability rights movement has taken up the motto, "Nothing about us without us." We've seen versions of that motto in lots of ways through this conference, I think. To stress how important it is that groups of people are involved in any decision making that concerns them. Disability rights activist Mike Oliver proposes an emancipatory paradigm for disability research in which researchers offer their skills to serve people with a disability, allowing them to determine the what, how, and when of the research process. I realise that for these actors with a disability, being asked their thoughts and opinions on the topic of drama and disability, or any topic, was revolutionary. While some enjoyed it as a novelty, others saw it as an important opportunity to have a voice. This led to a wholehearted participation and animated responses to questions in group interviews. And to what I term surprise data, which included unsolicited emails and other unexpected but welcome contributions to the research data. My project had become our project, and collaborative processes had served to reduce the distance between the researcher and the participants. In response to the revelation afforded by the research revolution, In response to the revelation afforded by the research revolution, my next project was conceived from the outset as a participatory action research in collaboration with people with a disability. And then I come in and talk about how much I like the term surprise data, and it's an interesting concept because it's often not welcome. Okay. Yet isn't that the point of doing research? And so I'm very conscious of time, but so the conversation continues, and it is a conversation through the chapter about what it looks like to do this work and some of the joys and some of the troubles, you know. So thank you very much for the opportunity for writing it. We really enjoyed the process.
Thanks, Kelly. The chapters are grouped, and in the first grouping, Provocations of Design, we've got the chapter by George Bellamy and Christine Sinclair, the chapter by Kelly Freebody and Joe Raphael, and a chapter by Kathleen and myself. Our chapter is ostensibly looking at ethics in drama research. And Kathleen and I had never written together before, but we've known each other's work for quite some time. And I think in many different forms, both as researchers of gender identity, ethnodramatists, and writers who are actually quite interested and curious about the whole area of ethics in research. And I think that's kind of, I think that's, because it wasn't, we made sure that our pairings, we didn't determine when the writers, because the writers, of the editors of the book, we've all got chapters there too, but we didn't, we weren't allowed to choose our co-writers. I thought that was just way too easy. So they were chosen for us. So we were paired up. However, what I would say is if there was anyone I would have chosen. I'll just say one more thing. The other thing I'd say is that we are, because Australia, Toronto, time difference couldn't be greater. We Skyped we Skyped our chapter, and it was always either very late at night in Australia and early in the morning in Toronto, or the other way around.
We did it both ways.
We were fair to each other. I will just share one little anecdote, which there is a reference in the chapter. Because I come from Australia, we don't have these animals. Some call them pests, I don't. But we don't have these animals in Australia. I was totally intrigued by the squirrels in Kathleen's garden. And she was totally enthralled by the kangaroos in my garden, because I'm in country Victoria. And so part of our convent, we tended to have lapses in our conversation where it got into the wildlife that you could see on the screen behind us as we were having our conversations. But certainly we wanted to try and capture the fact that this did come from a Skype conversation. We wanted to try and capture that feeling within the chapter as much as I can remember, and try and be as authentic to that as possible. Mm-hmm. Is there anything else you want to add?
Sure, I would just say when Richard reached out to me, and I thought he had chosen me. he said, would you like to have a conversation and talk about and write together about ethics? And I said, that sounds great. I love talking about ethics. And then he said, how should we do this? And we decided that what we might do is pose a few questions that we had about each other's work to each other. And we sent them to each other before we had met online. And I remember you saying, Richard, would you like me to send you my answers? And I said, no, don't send me your answers. Let's meet each other's answers in the Skype.
Yeah.
So we had a sense of what we wanted each other to address. And that, of course, caused the excavation of our own histories of practice and research and stories to make appreciable to each other how these ethical conundrums had come to be in our own research lives. So that was a lot of fun. And it's true that it was an added interest that it was very late for one of us and very early for the other both times, and that we intentionally wanted to switch that, who was in their pajamas and who was having their early morning coffee. And there was a lot of comings and goings of the day or night when we were writing. So that became a little bit of a backdrop to the stories that we were sharing.
Absolutely. Our chapter is called Learning on the Ground, How Our Research Stories Teach Us About Ethics. And I'll just read how the chapter starts. So it says, a conversation presented as a dramatic narrative between Kathleen and Richard about ethics in drama and theatre research. It is late at night for Richard in country Victoria, Australia, and early morning for Kathleen in Toronto, Canada. Richard is sitting at his kitchen bench, staving off tired eyes for this Skype session with Kathleen. They are recording their conversation. What follows is based on the Skype sessions that took place between them as they shared their views and experiences in regard to how ethics has played a part in their research and associated writing. Richard has scattered in front of him the notes he has made based on questions posed to him by Kathleen. And Richard starts talking, drinking a cup of hot tea. As well as answering or addressing the questions that we posed to each other, what we also did was that we did recount, I think somewhat courageously, I think at times, I certainly felt, incidents within our own research where ethical dilemmas had really posed themselves and how we kind of dealt with those. And one of the ones that I shared was a situation, I'll keep this very brief, but it obviously goes into a lot more detail in the chapter. When I was working with a senior class in a school and on an ethnodrama that the seniors, so these are our final year high school students, were developing about their own experiences of gender identity. And one of the boys decided that the play would be a perfect vehicle for him to come out to his parents. And it posed a great ethical dilemma, and I'll just pick it up at a point. I think one of the things that happened in that incident with Michael, that was the boy's name, or pseudonym obviously, was that when the problem first arose, I kind of looked to the teacher of the class as if to say, well, what are you going to do about it? And in response, the teacher looked back at me as if to say, well, what are you going to do about it? And it wasn't until that came up that I realised that I had been taken off guard. Up to that point, the research process had been relatively free from ethical challenges. I felt that I was in a very privileged position to be working with these people on my project, and that they were relying on me, and that I had to do my best by them wherever possible. It was actually quite sobering to have to admit to myself that I didn't have an immediate answer for the situation, and to confess this to others in the project as well. Once I shared my concerns and looked to others to help me address this dilemma, it was not only liberating, but a real lesson too. It was the close working relationship that had built over the course of the ethnography that enabled the drama teacher, the students and I to work together to work through Michael's situation, and obviously with Michael. What I've learnt is that when I'm conducting research and when I'm working as an ethnodramatist, similar occurrences to what happened in Michael's case will present themselves. At such times, it is more important to arrive at a process for dealing with these ethical dilemmas rather than being hard on myself because I can't come up with an immediate answer to the issue. And how the issue is resolved or otherwise, obviously, is addressed in the chapter. Kathleen and I did talk a lot about form, and like any process with the book, we submitted our first draft to the editors, and then it went out to readers and so on and so forth, and then we got some feedback, like all writers do, and addressed that feedback. But we decided to address the addressing of that feedback within the chapter as well. So,
what does a researcher miss? The editors of this collection asked us after they read our draft. How much does professional pride come into play when things don't go to plan? Good questions. I sometimes feel we over-rehearse certain kinds of risks or fears as scholars and practitioners. For example, people will discount our work, things we reflexively worry over in the field of drama theater research, and we under-rehearse others. I'm aware that I speak this as a privileged tenured professor and that risks are experienced differentially across a great range of different factors and positionings, and that while we may work in similar academic or school or theater institutions, they may also be vastly different spaces culturally and politically. Given that rather large caveat then, I think we would benefit from worrying a whole lot less about our research products and accomplishments in practice, and thinking a whole lot more about how we produce those products, the relationships we build with research participants and others with whom we collaborate, and how we fail as artists and practitioners.
The effect our researching has on participants and ourselves is a major interest and a personal challenge of mine. I realised long ago that when it comes to matters of ethics, I'm unlikely to ever come to a point where I will know exactly what I should do in every situation. However, what I can do is ensure that throughout the process I'm aware of what is at stake for all parties and help to steer us around the potholes and obstacles as they emerge. Sometimes the steering I might do takes us into uncharted territory, but I'd rather go there than opt for a soft option solution that halts the research opportunities in its tracks. I may not have the magic bullet solution, but I could help to work towards finding one, even if it means not everyone is going to be totally satisfied with the outcome.
Further, I think young people and all research participants deserve to see their lives treated with complexity. And so when academic norms or what gets legitimized in a field constrain our understandings or representations of them, we should push back hard and challenge norms and practices that diminish their personhood and their creative vitality. I think we need to risk not knowing a whole lot more.
Yes, and seeing what happens when we explore our not knowing with those we are working with on a research project. Just like the very best drama educators, as drama researchers, we should be brave enough and bold enough to sometimes step out of the frame and ask our co-researchers and participants, so where do you think we should go from here?
In rereading our draft myself, I was heartened by where Richard and I were able to go via Skype across great differences between our work and contexts, and great compatibilities in our interests and commitments. It made me think about the paucity of diverse experiences we have for strong dialogue among us, how conferences carve up ways of disseminating knowledge, not always with an eye towards the great power of dialogic exchange and experimentation, that we could and should do more with our luxurious position of freedom to learn. I feel hugely privileged by the many opportunities I'm afforded to speak with my colleagues and wonder together about ethical and artistic and scholarly ideas. And I am reminded about the squirrels and the kangaroos, about the important everydayness of our lives and our responsibilities to make the best of the space that has been cleared for us to follow our curiosities and live beside art.
We'll finish it there.
And next up
is a chapter by Yanika Greenwood and Diane Conrad. Yanika would have been here this afternoon, but has had to leave the institute. Yanika has sent me a little something, and I'm actually going to, rather than read it, I'm going to read a sort of across it, because I don't feel it's appropriate for me to read the chapter to Yanika and Diane's absence. The chapter is called Participation in Participatory Drama-Based Research, and it kicks off a section on provocations of method. What I think is very interesting in this highly theorised chapter between Diane and Yanika is that they also share very much aspects of their own background. And I think it's certainly being here at this institute in this country at this particular time, I think it's very appropriate for me to mention that Yanika talks very much about the place that she is in and the culture of which she is a part. She talks very much, for example, about the Treaty of Waitangi, for example. She talks about ancestors. She talks about her relationship with place and her relationship with land. Things that Yanika has talked about previously in some of her work, but I think it's beautifully crystallised in this particular chapter. The two writers who had not written together before were, again, a little bit similar to the process that Kelly and Joe went through. They initially shared writings with each other, some of which ended up in the chapter, some of which didn't, but it started off a conversation between them. And as you will see in the chapter when it comes out, there are kind of speech bubbles and thought bubbles from the two writers as they respond to each other's work. And I might leave that one there, I think, for today. So we move on. The next chapter is by Celine Busby and Brian Hee. Sorry, if I forgot his name. Oh, this also. Oh,
that's a good chapter about
you. Yeah. So do you mind holding on to one? So, Chris, would you like to introduce this one? Because clearly I'm rubbish at it.
Okay, under the provocations of method, just so funny, you think what the chapter is about.
Yeah, ironic.
Oh, the irony. It's a chapter on gender.
So we decided to Rich and I obviously go way back and have worked together in various other forms in Australia and written things together in different forms. And each of us separately have done work that has interrogated gender in the drama classroom. Rich is with boys, me with girls. So we thought, isn't it about time we talk to each other? And so what we decided to do, the youth, we wanted to look at perhaps our insider knowledge and our gendered lenses that we bring to the analysis of our own work as being members of those genders, so to speak, and what we would learn perhaps if we, a bit like tennis, threw a little something over the other side to see what we each think of a bite from each other's work. So without having any giving any context, we actually gave each other, very bravely I think, even though we know each other very well and adore each other, but you know, a bit of our raw data that we had used in other research projects where we had written and published on, and we just said, here's a bit. What do you think? What do you see that I can't see? What do you notice that that I've perhaps been blind to while I'm busy looking for the gendered information that I'm looking for? And so we shared this data, and then we engaged in a conversation about that. And then after that process, we decided that we really needed something to hang it together. So I said, Richard, I've got this great idea. We're going to create a new form of writing together in the form of a tango. So we've written a research tango in three moves. So we've used the metaphor of the tango to do basically three manoeuvres, where firstly, we offer the traditional idea of the man leading and the man's piece of data, and then at the turn, it switches over and it becomes my voice taking on and reporting or considering what I'm seeing. And then we come back to, it goes back, the lead of the dance goes back to whoever owns the data, and then we move on to the next one. So we tried to work with that metaphor the whole way through the piece and see if it works or it doesn't. So what we're going to perhaps give you is a bit of a snapshot of what it is.
Yeah,
so you get how we've used the metaphor. So this is a virtual dance. We have never danced together, Richard. We might after this. So this is a research tango in three moves, gendering the drama research space.
So we, the authors, present a research dance in this chapter, a tango. It is a metaphorical tango about our research work on gender in drama education. The dance we use here is virtual rather than embodied. It is co-constructed in language rather than an act of live, with bodies in a shared space. Unlike the tango, which is a dance of intimacy, this research tango is intimate in that both researchers share friendship and research interests in gender and previous collaborations about gender and drama, yet our written dance happens at a distance from each other. Given that we're separated by nearly 1,000 kilometres of Australian soil, Richard north of Melbourne and Chris north of Sydney, we conjure for this chapter a research dance where we move together, sharing our ideas and research spaces for the purposes of critical dialogue and insight about gender in drama research. At the centre of this chapter is a provocation about how gender impacts drama theatre research. We work with the key question, what affordances and challenges does a gendered lens in drama research provide for both researchers and their audience? As researchers who conduct investigations into the workings of gender in the drama classroom, we constructed this question because it provided a rich basis for our discussion and writing collaboration.
So we assert that gender should be central to the way that we work with drama in terms of both pedagogy and research. We wondered why gender is so often absent and an absent theme for analysis in drama research, and wonder what is lost or claimed when we strategically or inadvertently ignore it in our research. In this chapter, we revisit some of our own gender-based research projects and review how gender was both the subject and the lens for analysis. In this research dialogue, we consider how two data samples from past studies and how they reveal gendering at work in the drama classroom and as well in the drama process.
This research tango provides a metaphoric framework for our moves in this dialogue. As a dance steeped in heteronormative rules about gender, the tango most often has the man leading and providing the structure of the dance,
with the woman following, using adornments and flourishes in her movements to colour the dance. Yet it also has been a dance for crossing across gender norms. For this research tango, we start with the stance, position cero. This is the ground we stand on, a broad description of the conceptual and practice used when we research gender in drama and theatre.
We then work through an 8-count basic movement sequence as a framework for our discussion. We offer 3 moves, borrowed from those used in a traditional tango. The first move has the man leading the dance, the second move has the woman leading the dance, and the third has us both sharing back and forth the lead and the flourishing of thinking and theorising.
And we're obviously, from this point on, we're sort of cutting into the chapter. It doesn't necessarily run exactly like this. Imbrazo, the embrace. The dance begins with the imbrazo, an embrace to begin the dance. In this research embrace, hand in hand, we consider the ways in which gender works and is worked within drama research. In this dance, Richard leads us through his research world and practice. In this case, the man is leading and the embrace is a seemingly traditional tango abrazo. Salida, walk with me in my research space. Steps 1, 2, 3, 4. Richard's video and research context. The video recording I shared with Chris was an excerpt from a performance presented by Year 11 drama students as part of an ethnography I conducted at an all-boys private fee-paying school in the suburbs of Melbourne, Australia. Cruce, the crossover, when I walk in your research space. Chris, I'm interested in how you viewed the video excerpt I shared with you of the boys' performance through the lens of being another gender-based researcher.
In this data sample, the performers engage with a series of common masks that boys must obey, largely relating to studying drama and how they behave with each other. They speak in vernacular Australian macho talk, aligning drama as a subject with being gay. This gets laughter. They present masculine noises and greetings and body poses that are juxtaposed against later images of comic interpretive dance that's meant to represent soft work they do in drama. Where a teacher later encourages students to be a man and then roars when enrolled. Man is represented as lion, as animal. Male heteronormative sexualities are represented through the boys' school chair and weekend tales that cover homophobic representations of drama poofs, a derogatory term for gays, killing cats, drunken harassment of girls and picking up girls, sharing porn magazines at school, telling football stories, and sharing parental problems when your dad undermines your drama results as worthless. I wonder about the pedagogical moments that led to this performance and how the boys were guided and facilitated to develop this work, and also how they feel they engage their male audience. How does drama pedagogy open up or deny spaces for transgression or processes for enabling students to work deeply with the topics and ideas of relevance to them? My move. Chris leads the dance. The embrace. A new movement begins with a shift in the embrace, this time where the female researcher takes the lead and guides the move. Tango is denoted by the way the partners hold their hands and arms to claim the leadership dance. Salida, walk with me in my research space. This research space took place in an urban all-girls Catholic girls' system school and had a low to middle class population of girls that was culturally and linguistically diverse as a school.
Crusade, the crossover, partner walks in your research space. Looking at the video, I see Chris standing in front of a drama class in what appears to be an all-girls school. As a researcher into boys' education in drama, what I'm struck by immediately is how quiet and seemingly compliant the students appear. There is little to no restlessness and all eyes are focused on Chris. There is a neatness about the look of the class. Even the students' uniforms are appropriately worn uniformly. This is so different to the male-dominated classes that I'm used to researching. I wonder what the brief was that Chris has been given. Have there been problems at this school regarding the ostracising of students? And or does the school have students who come from other schools who have had trouble being accepted?
We're cutting to the end of the whole chapter. We write our conclusion in a shared voice in the quartet, which is about to end the dance.
Writing this chapter has reminded us how complex the phenomenon of gender-based research and gender in drama and theatre research can be. It has led us to ponder whether it is because we are gender-sensitive in our research practices that gender features so predominantly in our work.
And alternatively, we wonder, is it because we have an interest in gender and drama that our research practices have become more attuned to and nuanced in regards to gender performance in drama? Our invitation to you, dear readers, is to join us in risking a reconfiguration of your own research stance.
Wow. Okay, thank you.